Hi, my name's Sam Bailey and I'm the Managing Director of the Radio Academy. This week's podcast episode is a bit different to usual, not least because I'm hosting it instead of Roisin, who's back next week. This week's episode is a conversation I recorded recently with Tim Blackmore. In case you don't know who Tim is, he's a bit of a legend, one of the founding parents, I think, of British pop music radio. He helped launch Radio 1 in 67, helped reboot Capital in 77, and practically invented the independent audio sector with his company Unique in the 1980s. He was also one of the founders of the original Sony Awards and of the Radio Academy itself. Recently, Tim started telling the world that he wasn't very well. He has a glioblastoma, a brain tumour, that he's been told leaves him only a few weeks to live. In his typical pragmatic style, he's been very open about it and invited me to his home in Cheltenham to talk about it.
I've had an extraordinary week because about 10 days ago I was told I'm going to die and there's nothing can change that. I decided to tell people that that's happening. Since when, I have been quite literally deluged by emails, and I haven't seen so much snail mail in years. It's the only upside to knowing that you're going to depart this mortal coil is that you kind of get to read some of your obits.
This isn't a biographical interview. If you want to hear a brilliant hour on Tim's career, I'd really recommend his Radio Moments conversation with David Lloyd. I'll put a link in the episode description. Instead, this is a set of reflections on Tim's 60 years in an industry he has loved and given so much to. Perhaps a little self-indulgently, I did want to talk about his recollections about the founding of the Radio Academy, and I started by asking him to set the scene of the UK radio industry at the start of the 1980s.
We are talking about a point in radio history when the emergence of there being any broadcasting other than that by the BBC was still new. Commercial radio had begun 10 years earlier, 1973. I was still at the BBC until 77 when I left. And at that point, the atmosphere was quite bizarre because it was very clearly them and us. The BBC were very nervous of the fact that the competition had come along. They'd been hit quite hard by the competition arriving in television with ITV, and then along it came for radio as well, and they weren't quite sure what to do about it. They did start to invest more in BBC radio in response to it, but they were two separate worlds. Now, at the Radio Festival, which in those days was organised by Broadcast Magazine in Edinburgh, in August 82, and there the managing director of BBC Radio, Sir Dick Francis, made a speech in which he said he felt that the radio industry needed a body to represent it as an industry. And he set in motion the creation of a working party. Now, I wasn't on that party, but people like Caroline Millington, who became the first chairman of the Academy, John Bradford, Peter Baldwin from the IBA, they formed a working party to knock it into shape. They came down, summoned a meeting in London. There was an important meeting the next year, in 83, at the ICA, which was a public meeting in which radio professionals came together, and we talked at the ICA about what kind of organisation we wanted. I think it was the late, great Lord Gordon, Sir Jimmy Gordon, who proposed that it should become an academy, and it grew from there. The interesting thing is that simultaneously something else was going on. Because a man called Alan Zafer, who was a very prominent promoter of big corporate events and things like that, was working for the Sony organisation. And Sony were looking for a sponsorship deal of some sort where they could ally them something where quality of performance, which tied with their technical ambition, would work. And Alan came up with the idea, well, what about quality radio programmes? So Alan brought all that together with the whole thing, created the Sony Awards. There is the programme for the Sony Awards from the 20th of April 1983, the very first one.
So that context in 83, then you've got there's a nexus of things going on, isn't there, that results in these two initiatives, the awards and the Academy. So what do you think was the kernel of the idea, or the initiative, the purpose that founders of the Radio Academy wanted it to achieve at that point?
It was very much to be a charitable organisation. It was based very much on pursuit of excellence, on developing standards that could be grown, and we did lots and lots of things like workshops going around the country. I mean, I travelled, I mean, the whole goddamn country. I mean, I ended up much later, 87, 88, 89, I became the first director of the Radio Academy and started bringing in sponsorship for our events and things like that. So that was very exciting. But the overall ethos was, how can we help to make, first of all, create the sense of a radio industry, but also to be a sense of a radio industry that cares about the quality of what its output is, not just the quantity, but also the quality. And I think we did spectacularly well. Mm.
And what's the sort of structure of the commercial side of the industry at that point? How many? Because I imagine a lot of this is about bringing people together. Whereas in a world in 2022 where there are sort of three dominant commercial players, there were how many?
When we started, we were only about 19, 20 stations. It was relatively small. It was the big cities, and that was it. You know, it went down to sort of the smallest might have been Ipswich or something like that. So it wasn't at all huge. But what was interesting then, which I think has changed now, is that it was then an industry run by the pioneers who were absolutely passionate. They were people who had come from radio experience throughout the Commonwealth. They came from British Forces Broadcasting. They came from people who were bored with their lives in the BBC and wanted to be able to inject a bit more passion into what they were doing. And so all these stations, whether it was BRMB in Birmingham, Capital in London, where I was, there was an enthusiasm that was phenomenal, all run by young people.
What were the common areas, I suppose? You've got different ambitions, you've got different local bases, you've got different owners, but you've got a common passion, I suppose.
Well, you have a passion, and it was a dual passion. One, to provide output that people really felt they needed to hear, but also to actually have an involvement directly in the community. Almost every single one of those stations had very active phone line services. You know, things like flat share services, swapping products. Quite a few stations actually had up to 24-hour-long helplines with two or three phone operators running right the way through the day, helping people with whatever problems they came their way. I mean, I remember John Whitney said to me when I had my first interview with him when I was headhunted, he said, "I want Londoners to believe that unless they are listening to Capital Radio, they're actually not plugged into London life at all." And that was the ethos that we had. What we were trying to do, I think, from those early days of Capital was to put our stamp on London. I mean, if there was a big event in London, even if we had no financial involvement with it at all, you would get the sense, listening to our output, that we were running the thing. You know, if there was a big gig, we would do the build-up through the evening. When the concert ended, we would be talking to people on their way home from the concerts. If I went to a concert, and it was, I remember going to a Bob Dylan concert at Earl's Court, when he did the concert that came out as the Live at the Budokan, those arrangements. The moment Dylan came off air, I went to the phone box in Earl's Court, rang Tony Myatt, was doing the Late Show on air. I said, "Grab me a great Dylan track, probably off Blonde on Blonde, and then put me to air. Just say, Bob Dylan's left the stage of the Earl's Court, Tim Blackman was in the audience." And I did a straight review, straight to air. The next morning I came into the office and the managing director said, "My God, Tim," he said, "what were you on last night?" So I have no idea what I'd said, but obviously I was phenomenally excited. But that was what we did. We did everything possible to try and persuade our listeners that we were at the heart of everything that was London life. And it was just a phenomenal experience. My fear for radio now is that an awful lot of it is getting blanded out. You know, the guts are disappearing and it becomes more and more superficial. But, you know, that's just a cynical old man's view.
And then you were the first director. So there's a point a few years later where things have clearly, time to step up a gear.
They stepped up a gear, and there wasn't enough money to fund me as a full-time director. I did that for 2 years, till 1989. Can I tell you a story why I stopped?
Sure.
Alongside my radio career, I've done a lot of event production. I produced the Ivor Novello Awards for 20 years. I produced the Brits for 3 years. Should have produced it for 4 years. But for the 1989 awards, they asked me if I would be the solo producer with nobody else. previous years had been joint producers. And I said, well, I'm happy to do it. And they said, we want you to sign a contract whereby you clear your diary for 6 months before the event, and for 3 months after the event, you will work exclusively for us, for a very handsome fee. And so I did that. And so the Academy job had to go for that. As we got closer towards the event, I was summoned to a meeting with the head of the BPI, where he said, for this year's show, Tim, we don't want to use your broadcasting friends to present the show, because I liked working with Noel Edmonds because he's great live. And they said, we don't want you to use Noel Edmonds. I said, well, what do you want me to do? They said, we want you to use pop stars to present the show. And I said, well, how does that work? I said, I need live contact communication. They said, well, it's all right, because they can do it on auto cue. I said, no, it won't. Pop stars can't respond to auto cue. You can't change the auto cue quickly enough. Well, no, he said, it'll be absolutely fine. You know, I said, it won't. I said, the only compromise I can come up with is if we have two. I said, you can have a double presentation, you can have a pop star, you can have a broadcaster, but I have to have a broadcaster. Okay. Anyway, the next morning I got a phone call from the gentleman, and he said, again, it was one of those don't shoot the messenger calls. It was, I'm afraid you're off the case, Tim. And so it was that on the night of the 1989 BPI Brits Awards from the Albert Hall, I watched Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood destroy the entire event. And everything that I'd predicted happened fell apart.
A legendary year.
So my
cautionary tale.
Yes.
Everyone talks about that that year still.
I was the one they fired to make it possible.
I think you were best off out.
I think of the many jobs I've done, I mean, obviously my passion has been making radio and helping to run a few radio stations, but it's really been, I think, the overall industry jobs that have kind of given me the greatest satisfaction. You know, working with the Academy, certainly one, producing the Ivor Novello Awards, and the last thing I did, which was running the chairing the committee for the organisation of the Sony Radio Academy Awards, because they started as the Sony Awards, but then we merged them with the Radio Academy, because the Radio Academy was talking about starting its own awards. And as I was on both sides, I thought, this is nonsense. Why don't we just put them together and then, you know, we can build on both. But the 13 years of chairing the committee were one of the most enjoyable jobs I've ever had. I had a huge board. I've got no idea how I got so bored. But I think at one point it was like 18, 19 people, I mean, which is a big meeting to handle. But I have to say that people came to those meetings willingly, and most people seemed to enjoy them.
It strikes me that sort of period from the start of the Academy to through your chairmanship of the awards was about bringing together disparate interests, unifying people around their passion again. You know, it's an observation, but I don't know if you how do you reflect on, I guess, the diplomatic nature of your contribution to the industry?
Well, I think I am something of a diplomat, or I wouldn't have lasted as long as I did. I have two philosophies which have guided me through everything I've done. My first is that if you try to treat other people the way you'd like them to treat you, it delivers results. People respond positively. And the second principle is, if you take an interest in other people, that enables relationships to build. And if relationships build, then there's mutual trust grows. And if there's a mutual trust, it's absolutely staggering what can be achieved. There is a secondary one to that, which was something that my father said to me years and years ago. He was a Methodist minister. I don't have a religious faith, but he was a Methodist minister. And he said to me, Tim, he said, it's amazing how much you'll be able to achieve if you don't mind who gets the credit. And I often found that even if I was pushing things in a certain direction, providing I ensured that other people felt that they were getting the credit for what was being achieved, then things moved forward a hell of a lot more smoothly than might other have been the case.
It strikes me, looking back at your career, that you seem to be at the vanguard of a lot of really big things. Do you feel...
That's, I'd forgotten that. You're right. Because I got... When did I... I don't know when it was. I was at a radio festival in Manchester, and I didn't realise that I was going to get any awards or anything until the lovely TV presenter Sarah Green went up on stage, and she started talking about this bloke who had helped various people to do things. And I looked at my wife and I just thought, this sounds a bit like me. And she just smiled at me. Anyway, Sarah eventually came to the end, and the Academy very graciously presented me with the John Peel Award for Outstanding Contribution to Music Radio, which is an award that I invented, because I invented it when I created the Music Radio Conference back in 85. And I knew as I got up and walked towards that stage, I had to say something. And I couldn't think what to say. But what dropped into my head was, I've been so lucky. I was there in the summer of 1967 when we launched Radio 1. In 1973, I was approached to go and join Capital Radio. I couldn't go for a couple of years because I was finishing a big BBC series called The Story of Pop. But then I did go and join Capital. So I was there for those pioneering years of Capital Radio. When I left Capital Radio, I got involved in the launch of the Sony Awards. Simultaneously, I got in launch with the group that set up the Radio Academy. Then in 1989, I got together with a guy called Simon Cole from Piccadilly Radio Manchester, and we launched what effectively became the UK independent production sector. And then I ended up actually chairing those Sony Awards that I'd helped to launch. So at those key points throughout the industry, I just, by some sheer fluke, found myself there. And I just thought I was very jammy. I mean, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
The industry's changed a lot. You've observed, overseen a lot of change in 60 years.
60.
What's your perspective on the radio and audio sector now, and what's your how do you personally, as a lover of the medium and someone who's worked in I feel like all three sides of it, BBC, commercial and indie, what do you make of the state of affairs, I suppose?
I think it's phenomenally exciting. It's never been more exciting. I mean, there are just so many avenues now. I mean, I love the fact that any of us can be our own programme controller. Any of us can be our own programmer, our producer, even a presenter. You can do whatever you want because of the availability of the technology that makes it possible. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this.
What do you think the role of the Radio Academy might be now, or is now, or should be now? What advice might you give me, or anybody involved in the Radio Academy, if we want it to last another 40 years?
Well, I think far be it from me, you know, I'm 78, to give advice. It's probably too late for that. But I think the fundamental thing is what matters, which is what we started at. You know, that the important thing of the Academy is to underline the fundamentals that really do matter. We only have two tools. We have words and music. Most of our music is made by other people and delivered to us, and we use it. But our words are our own. Providing we choose our words wisely, providing we relate honestly to our listener, providing we seek to uphold those things which are decent, truthful, you know, that we seek always to search out the best. I mean, I think people are starting to find ways now in which they can sort out their thoughts before they go to air. It used to be very random. Now, because the disciplines of programming patterns require a great deal of, you know, maybe I'm only going to get this in 40 seconds. Maybe I'm only going to speak once in the next 10 minutes. Therefore, I will think very carefully about the power of my words, because the words are what make the contact. That's where you connect with another human being. And providing the Academy works to encourage people to believe this is not something to be treated flippantly. Of course we must have playtime, and I love playtime. You know, to me, pulling the cork at 6 p.m. is one of the things that life is about. But providing that we treat our work as a serious thing that can quite genuinely enhance the human experience in ways that very few other things can. You know, the intimacy of radio communication has always been its most powerful thing. And that's what we have to celebrate. That's what we have to hold on to. Because there's an awful lot of people are listening to radio on their own, whether they're in their car, whether they're in their bedroom, it doesn't matter, but they're on their own, and it's a totally personal experience, and I love it.
You say, far be it from you to give advice, but citing your age, but I'm afraid that makes you an industry elder. and you know, many people that I've spoken to, certainly in the last week, credit your wisdom and your support. Do you like that role? I mean, do you like giving advice? Do you?
Well,
you must get asked
if I can just be very personal for a moment. I've had an extraordinary week because about 10 days ago I was told I'm going to die, and there's nothing can change that. I decided to tell people that that's happening. Since when, I have been quite literally deluged by emails, and I haven't seen so much snail mail in years, coming through the letterbox here. And, you know, some of our viewers, listeners might have seen some of the Twitter feeds that's been going around. And I have just been so deeply flattered by comments, in particular from people I don't recall. You know, incidents that passed me by. I mean, I had one yesterday from a gentleman who apparently I interviewed for a job in 1984. I did not give him the job, but I so inspired him for love of radio that he went on and got himself a job in our industry, and he's now been a frontline broadcaster. I won't name him. He's now been a frontline broadcaster for 38 years. Now, I did not recall that at all, but this guy, God bless him, wrote in just to say, I want you to know that. And that has been totally typical. Alongside that, there have been some quite spectacular letters and messages, including from, I'm now bragging, you know, some of the nation's biggest broadcasters who, in the early days of their careers, I was able to guide them and help them along the way. So that has been, it's the only upside to knowing that you're going to depart this mortal coil, is that you kind of get to read some of your obits. And it's been a very warming, embracing kind of experience. And if you were one of the people who wrote to me, thank you.
And given perhaps this opportunity to send a message to colleagues, to the industry, what might you like to say to them?
That's heavy, because what would I like to say to people? I would just say to somebody, try to be yourself, be sincere in what you do, because if you are sincere, other people will react to you in that way, and they will be sincere, and things will get better. I mean, I don't think I've ever treated anybody indecently. I don't think I've ever knowingly misled anybody. I've tried never to overpromise. My philosophy has always been to underpromise and to overdeliver. And you know what happens? It never lets anybody down.
What do you think then is, as you contemplate mortality, what do you think then is your legacy?
Legacy is a very grand word. I suppose I would like to say I think I treated people as decently as I can, and it worked for me, and I think it worked for most of them. So if you'd like to give that a try, that would be a nice legacy.
It's an honour it's an honour for me to be the managing director of the Radio Academy, in following in your footsteps and your many great successes. And it's a privilege to be able to have this conversation on behalf of the industry and in that role. And I guess the opportunity for me on the industry's behalf to say thank you.
Thank you very much. And I say thank you to the industry for giving me 60 greatly rewarding years full of satisfaction, excitement and fun.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much, Sam. Well, that didn't hurt.